a nation distrusted by its allies, blind to the activities of its enemies, and reviled by its people. He returned to his desk and started a video from one of the file folders still open on screen. He'd seen it before, but the excitement in the pit of his stomach was even more intense upon the second playing. Joe Rickman was wearing a cowboy hat and holding a beer bottle in one hand. He stared directly into the camera, eyes glistening and wild.
"Howdy, Irene. Thought we'd go for a change of pace on this one. I figured I'd help you out and tell you that I'm about to release proof that your buddy, Ben Friedman, at the Mossad, is the one behind the destruction of Iran's nuclear research facility a few years back, and that it was Mitch who came up with the BS cover story you fed the world. Add that to the fact that Kamal Safavi's probably spilled everything to the Ayatollah by now, and I'm thinking that Alexander's little Iranian love fest isn't going so well. May I suggest a fruit basket? In my experience, those always seem to smooth things over."
The video faded to black, and Taj wiped at the perspiration building on his flushed cheeks. The temptation to give the files to a team of ISI analysts was overwhelming, but impossible. It was far too sensitive to allow anyone else access to. He would have to personally sift through all of the information, cross-referencing it with ISI's databanks, and determining how it could be used to generate the maximum impact. There was little question that Irene Kennedy and Mitch Rapp would end up in an American prison. It was a sweet irony that two patriots, who had so brilliantly defended their country, would die in cages fashioned by the very people they had dedicated their lives to protecting. These were largely trivial matters, though. The Rickman files generated far grander questions that Taj was just now daring to ask. Was there enough information to provoke a military confrontation between America and Russia? Or, even more devastating, China? Could the former Soviet bloc countries be turned away from the West? Could he gain enough sway over Middle Eastern oil producers to create an oil shock that would collapse the American economy? Taj closed the computer files and moved them to a heavily encrypted drive that only he had access to. He stared at the progress bar as they were transferred, but didn't feel the sense of security he had hoped for. The reason was obvious. Kabir Gadai. The younger man had been a loyal and highly competent assistant for years, but he was also ambitious. Had he kept copies of the files and encryption key? Did he have designs on using them for his own benefit? It was unlikely, but the possibility was too great to risk. After he helped Taj close his fist around Pakistan, Gadai would have to be quietly dealt with. Accusations of treason or bribery had the potential to reflect poorly on Taj's fledgling administration, and therefore could not be tolerated. No, an accident, or perhaps even martyrdom. Gadai would become yet another inspiring symbol of the rebirth of Pakistan, a shining example to others as the country rose to its rightful place as the world's first Muslim superpower. Chapter 57. Over Northern Kazakhstan. Scott Coleman was standing in the plane's aisle, shouting into a satellite phone as he struggled to maintain his balance in the turbulence. The CIA pilot was more conservative than the Russian who had flown them to Irina Shulyov's camp and had wanted to fly around the storm. Rapp quickly made it clear that they were taking the shortest route. The only question was, who was at the controls? Coleman finally turned off the phone and tossed it onto an empty seat. 4 dead, including the girl who was shot. Everyone else is stabilized, and the team's getting ready to take the sleds to Ukhta. They'll be back stateside tomorrow morning. Rapp nodded. Pavel Kadzin's people, particularly the children, had been in bad shape. He left McGroenwick to save as many as they could. Whatever was going to go down in Islamabad, it wouldn't be a frontal assault on the heavily guarded presidential palace. The difference between him having 3 men or 1 wasn't going to matter.
"Get some sleep, Scott." The former SEAL thumbed back at their prisoner. "You don't want help?"
"I've got it."
Coleman retreated to his sofa mid-plane and fell onto it, nodding off almost immediately.
The ability to rest whenever possible was stressed in Special Forces training, and it was a lesson Coleman had learned well. Unfortunately, sleep wasn't an option for Rapp. He was on a laptop, paging through everything the CIA knew about Kabir Gadai. None of it came as much of a surprise. Well-educated, military background, impeccable record, wife, three sons, and daughter. A golden boy since the day he'd been born. More interesting were the few paragraphs of new intel on Ahmed Taj. Kennedy had started digging into his background when she'd first begun having suspicions about the man. None of it was particularly shocking, considering his success in the murky world of Pakistani intelligence. But there were unquestionably a few useful revelations. Whether they would be enough to get the job done remained to be seen. The plane dipped, and Rapp glanced over the top of his screen. Gadai was strapped into a seat at the back with his hands still secured behind him. The pain generated by his broken sternum had been working on him for hours now, and a thin trail of blood ran down his chin where he'd chewed through his lip. When their eyes locked, Rapp could see that the hatred burning there had intensified, a trend that needed to be reversed before it reached the point of no return. Gadai wasn't some run-of-the-mill jihadist. Based on his stoic performance in the snowcat and his unbroken silence on the flight, he'd been well-trained in the art of dealing with physical suffering. Of course, he would break eventually. Everyone did, but that would take time they didn't have. Rapp grabbed a bottle of OxyContin from the seat next to him and started down the aisle. The Pakistani watched his approach with an admirably blank expression. He was aware of Rapp's reputation and had prepared for what he believed was coming. Any sign of weakness or fear would be hidden for as long as possible. Gadai's jaw clenched, anticipating the first of many blows. There was nothing Rapp would have liked more than to oblige him. Unfortunately, circumstances demanded a different strategy. He shook two pills from the bottle and held them out. "For the pain. I've taken shots like that to the vest, and I know how bad it hurts." Gadai was predictably suspicious. His jaw tightened further, and he turned his head away. "Come on," Rapp said, sitting in the chair facing him. "If I wanted to drug you, I'd use a needle."
"I'll take nothing from you."
"I know you think we're enemies, but we're not." Gadai let out a short laugh, wincing perceptibly at the pain it caused. "We protect our countries, our homes, and our families," Rapp said. "We do what we believe is necessary. If you'd been born in America, you'd probably be working for me."
"I serve only the one true God."
"I have no problem with that. And if you and Taj take control of Pakistan, I figure I'm better off. Nations aren't a problem for the United States. We've been dealing with those kinds of enemies since we signed the Declaration of Independence. Chaos is a real thorn in our side, though. You and I both know that all this democracy talk from American politicians is bullshit. Muslim countries need a strong hand at the helm."
"I don't know what you're talking about."
As planned, Gadai was confused by how the conversation was playing out.
"What do you want from me?"
"We know that Taj is going to kill President Chutani at the state dinner tonight."
"What? Where did you get this information? It's absurd."
He was a good liar, but the pain, fatigue, and unexpected line of questioning were straining that skill past its breaking point. "You told me as much a few hours ago," Rapp said in a calculatedly bored tone. "Honestly, it doesn't matter. We've been under Taj for a long time. He's great at staying under the radar and playing the bland servant, but come on. Irene Kennedy wrote the book on that trick." Rapp tapped the bottle of pain medication again. "Are you sure? You look like you're really suffering." Gadai just stared defiantly at him. "The way I see it, Kabir, we both have serious problems."
"You more than me," Gadai responded. "All you can do is kill me. Send me to paradise."
"Actually, I can do a lot more than that. But let's forget about that for the moment. I think you know what I'm worried about."
"The files," Gadai said proudly. "The first step in the inevitable destruction of your corrupt and godless country."
Rapp rolled his eyes,
America's not going to be destroyed, Kabir. You're a smart guy. Let go of your ideology for a minute and think. For all the money we've poured into it, your military has never managed to win a war. And that's against the Indians. We're not the Indians.
We'll destroy your intelligence network, leave you defenseless, and your government in turmoil. We'll cut off your oil, and unlike you, we're prepared to use our nuclear arsenal. You profess to have faith in your God, but it's a lie. Christians fear death. They fear everything.
I'm sure that was the plan, but what do you think I'm going to do? Just sit back and let Taj make his move?
He's too clever for you, too dedicated, and too powerful within Pakistan.
Rap slammed a hand down on the table between them, causing Gadai to jerk back in surprise.
You want to sit here with stars in your eyes about Pakistan taking over the world? Rap shouted. Fine. I'll call President Chutani and tell him what's going on at the ISI. He'll spend the next 2 years cutting little pieces off Taj while I do the same to you.
Rap pulled out a switchblade, and Gadai tried futilely to twist away, but in the end, the knife just cut through his flex cuffs. Once they were severed, he moved his swollen hands to his lap, careful not to bring about another flash of rage in his captor.
It gets worse for both of us, Rap said, folding the blade and moderating his tone again. I don't trust Chutani. I don't want him to have those files any more than I want Taj to.
He let that statement hang, deciding to force the Pakistani to ask him to say more. Unsatisfying as hell, but it was how these standoffs were won. One small victory at a time.
And how does it get worse for me?
Gadai said, after almost a full minute of silence.
If I keep you, then Chutani's going to move against your family.
He'll figure there's a chance they know something that can help him. And he won't stop trying to get that information until they're dead. Gadai's eyes began to shift back and forth, focusing on everything in the small plane except the man in front of him. It wasn't hard to convince him of his wife and children's bleak future for one simple reason. It was the truth.
I heard a rumor that Chutani took a page out of Saddam Hussein's book, Rap said, looking out the window into the darkness. He likes to lower people's kids into vats of acid while their parents watch. Makes quite a mess, and I understand the smell is horrible.
It wasn't an observation that demanded a response, but Rap waited anyway.
The rumor is true, Gadai said finally.
Then let me ask you a question, Kabir. Do you think anything I've said to you tonight is a lie?
No.
Rap was in a virtually impossible situation, even if Gadai started talking. They were scheduled to land only an hour before the start of Chutani's state dinner, and he had no idea how he was even going to access the heavily guarded palace, let alone deal with Taj. I've spent most of my adult life in the Middle East, Kabir, so I know how people like you think. You sit in your fundamentalist echo chamber and talk about creating a thousand-year dynasty, about how God loves you best and how he's going to help you turn the world into some half-assed caliphate. But you graduated near the top of your class with a degree in history, right? So you know that Pakistan has a hard time going a week without a coup. If Taj takes over, how long is it going to be before the military figures out a way to get rid of him? Hell, how long is it going to be before he pisses off our president so bad that he sends me over to deal with the situation?
It's a pipe dream, Kabir. The whole world will line up against you like they did against Hitler. And Pakistan's not Nazi Germany. It's a mess of kooks and semi-literate fanatics who just as soon shoot each other as shoot us.
You want me to betray Taj?
Rap shrugged.
It's what he plans to do to you.
What are you talking about? I've been with him since I was a child. We're from the same family.
Maybe you're right. Maybe blood is thicker than water. But from what I heard, his last assistant ended up rotting on a trash heap. Kennedy had warned that the intel about Taj's involvement in that death was little more than hearsay, but the flicker in Gadai's mask suggested he'd heard the same story. Rickman's files are the key to Taj's power, and you've seen them.
You have the encryption key.
He knows I'm loyal to him, that I would die for him.
Correction, he's pretty sure you're loyal to him, and probably no better than 50-50 on whether you die for him. Put yourself in his place, Kabir. Would you take that chance? Gadai didn't respond. If you just let go of this world domination crap and take a clear-eyed look at your situation, you'll see that Taj is going to kill you. You don't owe him anything. He sent you to Russia with my team closing in. What do you want to bet? That he would have taken a more cautious approach if it had been his neck on the line instead of yours. You're sitting here because of him.
If I agree to cooperate, what becomes of me?
Normally, it was the question Rapp would be waiting for, an indication that Gadai was willing to deal. In this case, though, it was a dangerous crossroad. Did he lie and risk that Gadai would pick up on it, or tell the truth and risk Gadai not being able to handle it? In the end, he decided the latter path posed the least risk.
There is no you, Kabir. Chutani's going to want to get his hands on you something awful, and we have no legal authority to keep you.
Tell him I'm dead.
He's not stupid. He's going to want a body.
So you're offering me a bullet to the back of the head?
I'll leave the method to you, but that's the long and short of it. All I'm selling is the safety of your family.
And I'm to believe that you can guarantee this?
If I save Chutani's life, he's going to owe me. I'll call in that marker for your family. He won't have a problem with that. Your wife isn't the type to be involved in something like this, and your kids are too young. He's not going to cross me over some vague suspicions and a piece of pointless revenge.
Why would I trust you?
Rapp slid the OxyContin across the table, and this time the man accepted. You've read everything the ISI has on me, right?
Yes.
Then you know what I'm capable of. But you also know that I'm a man of my word. Chapter 58. Islamabad, Pakistan. Where are we going? Rep didn't look at the man driving, and didn't immediately answer. Bill Drake had been the station chief in Islamabad for years now, and he enjoyed Kennedy's confidence more than Rep's own. There was no question that he had a decent head for the constant push-pull between Pakistani factions, but he was an observer by nature. When it came time to act, Drake always had a reason that more data was necessary and more experts needed to be consulted. Paralysis by analysis. Rapp reached for the rearview mirror and adjusted it so he could see behind them. Keep going east. Coleman was still trying to get into the dark gray suit Drake had brought. Rapp's fit better, but not much. The fact that the pants were an inch too short was less a problem than the obvious bulge his Glock made beneath his right shoulder. Not that it was Drake's fault. Rapp had waited until the last minute to contact him, and the clothes were the result of the man sprinting through the only department store on the way to the airport. The traffic's not too bad right now, but the farther we go, the worse it's going to get. President Chutani's dinner for Sunny Wicca is tonight, and they've got everything around the presidential palace blocked off. You heard me. Is there anything I need to know?
No.
Rapp inserted an earpiece and dialed Kennedy on a secure sat phone. Not surprisingly, she picked up on the first ring.
Are you on the ground?
Yeah.
Time's tight, Mitch. We're less than an hour from the start of the dinner.
True to Drake's word, traffic was getting worse. A flatbed teetering with bales of cotton cut them off, forcing the station chief to slam on the BMW's brakes. The gap that opened between them and the back of the truck was immediately filled with motor scooters. The cause of the jam was just ahead and hard to miss, a tank parked sideways in the road. Beyond, Rapp could see the massive, bunker-like presidential palace illuminated with colored spotlights. A single limousine was gliding toward a set of barricades guarded by a group of soldiers. Other vehicles trailed at intervals designed to limit damage from a potential attack.
"We're approaching the palace now," Rapp said.
It doesn't look like we're going to be able to get the car close, though.
Drake gave him an inquisitive look, and Rapp pointed left. They diverted onto a narrower street, but soon found themselves stopped in a sea of blaring horns.
"Do you have a plan to get in?" Kennedy asked.
The truth was that he still didn't. He had no intel on Pakistani security, no layout for the building, and no guest list. Even the event schedule he had was just something pulled off a Pakistani news site, not exactly something he wanted to bet his life on.
"I'm still working on that," he said,
feeling around on the floorboard for the electric razor Drake brought.
"They have tanks," Coleman said loud enough for her to hear. "Tanks are usually not a good sign."
Rapp started into his beard with the clippers, debating whether to leave the mustache favored by ISI men. His skin wasn't quite dark enough to pass, but he might be able to create a second of hesitation on the part of anyone lining up on him. In the end, he decided against it and went with the clean-shaven look of the Secret Service.
"Then I think I have some good news for you," Kennedy said. "Guess who's consulting on the security for Sonny's delegation?"
"I'm not in the mood for games, Irene."
"Jack Warch."
Rapp stopped the razor midway through his chin. Warch was a former Secret Service executive who had started a private security firm a few years back. He was a solid man and a good friend. More important, he owed Rapp his life. With all the instability in Pakistan, the government decided to bring Jack in to stress-test the Secret Service's protocols, Kennedy said.
"No, our luck's even better than that," Rapp responded. "If Jack's here, he's not doing stress tests. He's in charge. No one at Secret Service is going to question him, and no one will have the guts to do anything but exactly what he tells them."
"I suspect you're right. I spoke to him earlier, and he seems to have a solid handle on things."
"Our chances of pulling this off just went from 0 to 10%. Did you tell him what's happening?"
"I thought you'd prefer to do that yourself. He's going to meet you outside the pedestrian gate on the palace's north side. But he's not happy about it."
"He's never happy."
"Like you."
Rapp ignored the jab.
"Does Sonny know?"
"No, she's not the target, and we can't afford to have her looking nervous."
"Understood."
"You haven't told me if you were able to get Gadai to talk."
"He talked."
"So you know Taj's plan?"
"Unless he was lying."
"Do you think he was?"
60-40 not.
"Where is he now?"
"Dead."
"Dead?"
The pitch of her voice rose perceptibly.
"What do you mean, dead? What happened?"
"It was part of our agreement." There was a brief silence over the line.
"We'll discuss that later."
"Have you talked to President Alexander?"
"I got off the phone with him 10 minutes ago."
"And?"
"He wants to have the banquet cancelled and tell Chutani what we know. Let him deal with Taj."
"That's going to leave Chutani with the files."
"In his mind, that's an acceptable compromise."
"If Alexander believes the President of Pakistan won't sell us down the river the second it's in his best interest, he's nuts. And even if Chutani were the Boy Scout, we know he's not. Are we sure he can keep that data under wraps? What happens when some ISI mole gets his hands on it? Or one of the 800 terrorist groups operating here? What happens when there's another coup?"
"My argument to him, exactly."
"And?"
"He's given us authorization to assess the situation. But under no circumstances are you to act without his express authorization."
"What's that? You're breaking up."
"I thought I might be."
"So I deal with Taj tonight."
"Neither of us is naive about these kinds of situations, Mitch. If it all goes right, our sins will be forgiven. If it goes wrong..."
She didn't have to finish the thought. Her expectation was that she would take the political bullet and he would disappear to the far corners of the earth. The world's governments would try to find him, of course, but he knew most of the people they'd send. Some would put on a show and cash their expense checks, but none would be stupid enough to succeed. Rapp dropped the razor on the floorboard and brushed the hair off his suit. He'd already made his decision. If he could get this done without exposing his involvement, he would. But if the only option was to beat Taj to death while his security detail emptied their guns into him, that's the way it would have to be. One way or another, Ahmed Taj wasn't going to see the sun rise.
Chapter 59.
Ahmed Taj extricated himself from a conversation with two of Pakistan's members of parliament and walked toward the center of the room. A uniformed waiter offered a tray of Obaid Mari's tiny creations, and Taj took one. He assumed that the other guests would find it exquisite, but he had never seen food as anything more than sustenance. President Saad Chutani was holding court on the south side of the hall, laughing easily with the American Secretary of State. His wife stood next to him, wearing an immodest Western dress, and holding a glass of wine produced locally by another of Pakistan's anti-Islamic economic initiatives. It was a display that made Taj wonder even more about the politician. Until that night, he had seen Chutani as the West's puppet, an ultimately weak man desperate to prove himself to his masters. Now, though, Taj's eyes were open. Chutani wasn't playing a role to ingratiate himself with the Americans. He was one of them. It was his identity as a Pakistani and a Muslim that was a lie. Predictably, Carl Ferris was at the bar. Despite having only recently arrived, his gait was already a bit unsteady. Not surprising. Taj's people reported that the American senator had consumed a quarter of a bottle of scotch in his hotel suite. Ferris started in his direction, but Taj scanned past him at the room itself. Soon it would be his. The presidential palace would become the center of modern Islam, and a base for spreading Sharia law throughout the world. All while the Americans watched helplessly. Chef Mari appeared in the kitchen doorway and surveyed the growing crowd, looking understandably nervous. He was carrying the poison Taj had given him hidden on his person. It was not the exotic toxin Taj had originally planned to use in order to further implicate the Americans. Instead, he'd chosen a mix of common compounds that would generate a much more sensational and horrifying death for the traitor Chutani. A death that would stir the rage and nationalism of even Pakistan's growing secular elite.
"Ahmed," Ferris said as he came within earshot. "Nice party."
Taj smiled warmly as they shook hands.
"I'm glad you approve. And I have to say that the security is impressive. They can't even keep people from climbing over the White House fence in my country."
He was speaking loudly enough to be overheard by people around them, and Taj made sure his response was sufficiently diplomatic.
"Your Secret Service is to be given a great deal of credit for what you see, Senator. My men have felt privileged to work with him."
Ferris frowned and looked around him at the dark-suited men blending in near the walls. Most were American, with much of the Pakistani detail doubling as waitstaff. Jack Warch, the consultant who had been so much trouble, was nowhere to be seen. Perhaps Gaddai had overestimated the man's diligence.
"At least you don't have to deal with the CIA. I'm telling you, it's one screw-up after another. We could use a man like you to straighten it out."
Implausibly, the idiot's voice had grown even louder. A man and woman Taj didn't recognize glanced inquisitively in their direction. Ferris was unquestionably a destructive force, but there was no telling from one moment to another what kind. Taj had hoped to use him as a scalpel, to slowly slice at America's heart. Based on his recent behavior, though, his destiny might be more as an indiscriminate bludgeon, less effective but still blessedly ruinous if enough force was applied.
"The world has become a complex and chaotic place, Senator. I'm glad to be heading a much more modest organization. I wouldn't want to be in Director Kennedy's position."
"Too bad," Ferris said, swilling his drink. "Because if I have anything to do with it, there'll be a job opening soon."
Taj put a hand on Ferris's back and nudged him toward the knot of people surrounding Sonny Wicca and the President.
"I haven't yet had the pleasure of meeting your Secretary of State. Perhaps you would introduce us."
"Sure, why not?"
"You go ahead, Senator. I'll be there in a moment."
Ferris forced himself into the group and immediately hijacked the conversation, while Taj found the head of Pakistan's security detail.
"Rearrange the place cards so Ferris is next to me."
The man nodded, and Taj returned to the senator's side. He would have to keep a close watch on the man while he was in Pakistan. It would be impossible to deliver this half-wit to the White House if he couldn't get through a simple state dinner without compromising himself.
Chapter 60 The Secret Service man was waiting in the shadows of a well-manicured stand of trees. 500 yards beyond, the presidential palace was lit up in yellow, green, and white. Pakistani special forces were everywhere, clad in dress uniforms but armed with automatic weapons that were in no way ceremonial. In addition to the tank Rapp had seen earlier, there were no fewer than 5 armored vehicles within view, 3 of which had mounted guns. "I've been told to take you to the side gate," the man said. Rapp didn't recognize him, but the young agent's nervousness suggested he knew exactly who he was dealing with. Coleman and Rapp followed along, keeping their heads down and managing not to attract any attention. Just 2 more Americans in dark suits, patrolling the area. Rapp studied the security in the palace courtyard as they skirted the fence. It was understated in an effort to seem welcoming to Sonny Wicker's delegation, but still solid. The fence itself was only about 6 feet tall, with the bars 8 inches apart. Easily climbable, but with the firepower in the area, it was unlikely that anyone trying would still be recognizable as human when they hit the ground on the other side. They found Jack Warch standing with his back against the bars, scanning the area in a calculated pattern. The retired Secret Service Assistant Director would have to be close to 60 now, Rapp knew. Backlit the way he was, fine details were impossible to pick out, but it was obvious he had a lot less hair and a lot more midsection than he'd had during his days protecting the President. "The private sector's made you fat," Rapp said as they approached. Their escort peeled off and headed for the main gate without a word. "And the agency's made you crazy if you think you're just waltzing into my operation like this. Bad things happen when you're around, Mitch." No one shook hands. It might seem suspicious to anyone watching. Warch did give a nod to Coleman, though. They'd known each other for years. "Chutani's going to be poisoned," Rapp said simply. Warch remained silent for a moment, processing what he'd just heard.
"How do you know?"
"I know."
"Who's making the move?"
"Taj." Warch's expression turned skeptical.
"My ass, he can barely get out of his own way. That's why Chutani put him in as head of the ISI.
Rapp just stared at him.
"All right, fine. I only have authority over U.S. security, but I'll talk to my counterpart on the Pakistani side. I'm not sure he trusts me, but he'll listen to a potential threat. Do you know how it's going to go down?"
"I might."
"Give me the details, then. That should help."
"We're not getting him involved, Jack. You and I are going to handle this."
"Yeah, Irene told me you'd say something like that. Listen, Mitch, security is wall to wall, and there's a lot of tension on both sides. Basically, you've got a powder keg ready to go off, and what I don't need is you going in there throwing matches."
"I've always liked and respected you, Jack, but right now, I don't care what you think. Get me inside and do it now." Warch hesitated for a moment, and then reached into his pocket. Rapp assumed the man wouldn't do anything stupid, but crossed his arms in a way that brought his hand closer to his weapon inside his jacket. There was too much at stake to take chances. When the former Secret Service man's hand reappeared, it held a laminated badge.
"This guy looks as much like you as anyone I have. I've pulled him, and you're going to take his place."
He glanced at Coleman.
"I'm sorry, Scott. You'd stand out like a sore thumb in there. I don't have any blonde guys."
"Mitch," Coleman protested. "Go back to the car and keep your eye on Drake. Make sure he doesn't lose his nerve and take off."
"The car? Shouldn't I be closer? I can cover—"
"Not up for discussion, Scott. If this goes right, I'm going to walk out the main gate. If it goes wrong, there's nothing you or anyone else is going to be able to do for me."
Rapp glanced down at the badge, noting the name, and then hung it around his neck.
"Let's go, Jack."
They walked to a heavily guarded service entrance where Warch cut left and went around the metal detector. He lectured Rapp about some imaginary screw-up, loud enough that everyone understood they were together and angrily enough that no one dared interrupt. When they were out of earshot of the checkpoint, Warch lowered his voice and looked down at the ground to obscure his lips from anyone watching through a scope.
"We're in a shoot-first-ask-questions-later environment, Mitch. With the terrorist shitstorm going on in this country, Chutani's made it clear that this dinner is to go off without a hitch. If it doesn't, his security people and their families are going to end up in a hole somewhere. Every finger on every trigger is shaking as near as I can tell."
"Where does that leave your guys?"
We have a fairly free hand. The head of Chutani Security knows that having us here can't do anything but help him. Best case, he's got a bunch of extra guns. Worst case, he's got a scapegoat.
They entered the presidential palace through an unassuming door, isolated from the pomp and circumstance of the main entrance. This time, Warch greeted the Pakistani soldier manning the security station by name and asked after one of his children. Rap was completely ignored. They continued down a broad hallway, passing no fewer than 5 Pakistani security personnel and a man carrying a silver tray who looked suspiciously fit and alert. At the end of the corridor, they ducked into a room lined with monitors. The 2 men watching the various video feeds immediately stood. Warch thumbed toward the door.
"Why don't you guys take a break?"
As they passed, Rapp began to suspect that Warch's initial protests had been just for show. The American seemed prepared for his arrival, and it was hard not to notice that all the security checkpoints had been manned by Pakistanis whom Warch was on friendly terms with. When the men were gone and the door was closed, Rapp approached the largest of the monitors. It depicted a richly decorated room, full of well-dressed people grazing on food arranged on a central table. Sonny Wicca was one of a small group that included Saad Chutani and his wife. More interesting, though, was Ahmed Taj, who appeared to be making an effort to stay close to Carl Ferris. The senator had a good-sized scotch in his hand and already looked drunk. It was a match made in hell, Rapp knew. A foreign intelligence czar who wanted to take down the CIA and a megalomaniacal American senator with exactly the same goal. How deep was Ferris in this thing? Would it be worth putting the screws to him? Probably not. He was a moron, and Taj would be smart enough to keep him in the dark. The Pakistani would just play on Ferris's ego and greed for power. He wore both on his sleeve. Rapp recognized a few other members of Congress, but none were important or dangerous enough that he had bothered to remember their names. Warch's men were also in evidence, trying to blend into the walls. No Pakistani security presence was obvious, but Rapp suspected he knew why. "Are all the waitstaff ISI?" "Yeah. It's driving that prick of a chef nuts. They've been training for a month, but some of them still don't know a dessert fork from a hole in the ground." "When this thing hits the fan, get Sonny and her people out first." "When what hits the fan, Mitch?" Rep ignored the question. "Where's the dinner being served?" Warch used a computer mouse to switch to a view of the dining room. The only people in it were a few kitchen staff and a man in a chef's uniform screaming at someone trying to straighten a listing ice sculpture. "Is that Obaid Mari?" Warch nodded. "The only person my guys are more afraid of than me. He hit a black stork with a frying pan for knocking over a flower display. Nearly cold-cocked the guy." "I'm surprised he got away with that." "Totally protected. I guess he's some kind of hot-shit cook. Chutani loves him." Mari shoved the man working on the sculpture and then stalked toward a set of double doors. A moment later, he appeared on the monitor displaying video from the kitchen. "I'd like an introduction."
"To Mari? Trust me, you don't."
Warch glanced at his watch.
"Look, Mitch, they're going to start seating people for dinner in less than 2 minutes. After that, you've got maybe another 15 before the soup starts rolling out. Are you going to tell me what we're doing here?"
"Take me to Mari," Rapp said. "I'll fill you in on the way." They entered the kitchen and Rapp stopped for a moment, flipping his ID badge to face his chest and surveying the tightly controlled order. Obaid Mari ran his kitchen like an African dictator, and one of his standing orders was that no waitstaff was allowed inside unless they were serving. That meant no ISI. With the exception of him and Warch, everyone in the room was a professional cook. And by the looks of them, they were all terrified of the man in charge. Only a few dared even a brief glance in their direction before returning to whatever they were chopping, stirring, or arranging. No one but Mari spoke, and he was too absorbed in doing just that to notice Rapp and Warch approaching from behind. Finally, he heard their footsteps and spun. He fell into a stunned silence for a moment before jabbing a chef's knife in their direction.
"What are you doing in here? Get out! Do you hear me? Get out!"
That turned out to be enough for everyone to stop what they were doing and watch, a problem Rapp had anticipated.
"Chef Mari, I'm Mitch Keller." What? Why are you speaking to me? Why do I care who you are?
I'm Thomas Keller's brother, Rapp said, using a name he'd pulled off the internet on the way there. Apparently Keller was one of America's top chefs. Mari lowered the knife.
From the French Laundry?
Rapp smiled and nodded. He wanted me to send his compliments if I got a chance. He's planning a trip to Pakistan next year, and was hoping to get a chance to meet you. Rapp extended his hand, and Mari, still looking a bit confused, reached for it. With the fireworks over, the kitchen staff went back to concentrating on their tasks, so no one noticed when, instead of shaking hands, Rapp grabbed the chef's testicles and gave them a hard squeeze. Mari doubled over, his breath coming out in a loud rush. Once again, all eyes were on them.
"Chef, are you all right?"
Rapp said, feigning concern. He slid an arm beneath Mari's and pulled him upright. The man was trying to speak, but, as planned, the pain and surprise prevented it.
"It's the heat,"
Warch said to the staff as Rapp led the man to a walk-in refrigerator.
"He'll be fine. Just keep doing what you're doing. We have to stay on schedule."
It was one of the drawbacks to treating your staff like slaves, Rapp reflected. None had the courage to question or take charge. In the absence of Mari screaming orders, they listened to anyone with a plan and an authoritative manner. Warch rushed ahead and opened the thick metal door, following Rapp and Mari inside, before pulling it closed.
"Are you—" the chef managed to get out. "Are you insane? Do you know who I am? President Chutani—"
Rapp gave the man an open-handed slap to the face that was hard enough to knock him to the floor.
"Mitch,"
Warch cautioned.
"If you can't handle this, Jack, get out. I'd just like to avoid getting shot or thrown in jail."
Mari raised his arms defensively, and Rapp knocked them out of the way before grabbing the front of his coat.
"We know all about your plans with Taj."
"What? You're crazy!"
Mari looked up at Warch.
"Get him off me. I don't know what he's talking about. I don't even know I'm at Taj. I work for the president."
"Really? Because I hear that you grew up in the same town. That you both attended a madrasa financed by Taj's father. Not too many people know that, though, do they? Because the place burned to the ground, and the administrators are all dead."
"It isn't true. Who told you this?"
"Kabir Gadai."
The fear in his eyes grew, but he repeated his protest, this time even more emphatically. Men like him were all the same. They became accustomed to their position of unshakable authority, and it made them prone to panic when it slipped away.
"Where's the poison?"
"Poison? I—"
Rapp clamped a hand around the man's throat, silencing him while he searched through the pockets of his chef's jacket. It was possible the vial could be hidden in the kitchen, but it seemed unlikely. Too easy for someone to stumble upon it. There was a hesitant knock on the refrigerator door, and Warch opened it a crack. Rapp heard a quiet voice, and he tightened his grip on Mari's throat.
"Is the chef all right?"
"He's fine," Warch said in a reassuring tone. "The heat of the kitchen got to him, but he's feeling better. He'll be back out in a moment."
By the time he pushed the refrigerator door closed again, Rapp was finished with his search. He'd come up empty.
"Please tell me your informant didn't lie to you," Warch said.
"Shut up, Jack."
"Come on, Mitch. This guy's famous all over the world, and Chutani thinks the sun shines out of his ass. You'll walk away, but I'm screwed. I'm paying for grandkids in private school, and I've got a daughter getting married next month."
Rapp was convinced that Gadai had been telling the truth, and that the hyperventilating man on the floor was the one lying. But with no way to prove it and time running out, he was left with only one option: to walk into the dining room and put a bullet in Taj's head with half the world watching.
"Get off me!"
Mari said, swinging a fist in what passed for a weak right cross. Rapp blocked it easily, and when he did, something caught his eye. The edge of the chef's thumbnail had been filed to a sharp point. Rapp examined it for a moment, and then dropped a knee into the man's chest.
"Mitch!" Warch said from behind him. "This has to stop! It's time for you and me to get out of here before anyone finds out this happened!"
Rapp pushed up the left sleeve on Mari's chef's coat. He knew he was onto something when the man suddenly found the strength to start thrashing. Rapp rammed the back of his head into the concrete hard enough to daze him, but not hard enough to knock him out. The groan that followed came from Warch, not Mari. Rapp finally found what he was looking for on the underside of the man's forearm.
The tiny blister pack was completely invisible, colored to perfectly match Mari's skin and glued down seamlessly. The only way he could tell it was there was the soft, fluid feel.
"Got it," Rapp said, on his arm.
Warch let out a long breath.
"Thank God."
When the effects of his head hitting the floor faded, Mari started to whimper.
"Everything stays the same," Rapp said, dragging him to his feet. "Except you put that in Taj's food instead of Jutani's."
"I won't. I made Taj a great man. He will create a new Pakistan that will—"
Rapp had heard enough of this Muslim superpower bullshit from Gadai, and his patience was finished. The dossier on Mari had been thrown together at the last minute from public domain information, but it didn't paint a picture of a man with any real convictions. He was neither a religious fundamentalist nor a political radical. No, Mari was just a pathetic little man looking to better his social status. He had no desire to martyr himself. Rapp glanced back at the slabs of meat hanging near the rear of the refrigerator. Finding an empty hook, he grabbed Mari with both hands and began driving him back. When they were less than 3 feet from the steel spike, he lifted the chef off his feet.
"Stop!"
Mari's scream was loud enough that it would have been heard throughout the palace if they hadn't been closed up in the refrigerator. Rapp didn't stop, though. He accelerated. Mari's back was only inches from the hook when Rapp pulled right and slammed him into a wall stained with dried blood. The man was blubbering now, and his legs wouldn't support him. When he crumpled to the ground, Rapp went with him, grabbing the back of his hair and forcing him to meet his gaze.
"Decision time," obeyed. "I leave you here on a hook, or you do exactly what I tell you."
"I'll—"
he stammered.
"You'll what?"
"I'll do it."
Rapp pulled the man to his feet and shoved him toward the door. Mari stumbled, but Warch caught him. He straightened the man's coat and wiped away the tears that had started to flow down his soft cheeks.
"Stay calm, chef. It'll all be over in a few minutes."
Chapter 61 Rapp kept his eyes locked on Obeyed Mari. The red marks on his throat and right cheek were still visible, and he was sweating profusely. But those things were plausibly explained by the heatstroke story. If the kitchen crew had any curiosity about what happened in that refrigerator, or why there was a security man standing watch over the kitchen, they didn't show it. Mari was working on a bowl of soup, carefully arranging sprigs of cilantro before tapping chili powder artistically over the top.
"Secretary of State Wicca,"
he said to the server waiting obediently at the end of his work table. The man took it and hurried toward the door. Despite actually being an ISI operative, he passed by without giving Rapp so much as a glance. Such was the power of Chef Obeyed Mari to beat down anyone in his presence. He continued to personally adorn the dishes of the most important guests, prioritizing them based on the complex protocols that politicians were so obsessed with. While Rapp spent his time being shot at in places without electricity or running water, the world's elected officials filled their days worrying about who got the shiniest fork. Jack Warch entered the kitchen and took up a position next to Rapp.
"I've got nothing. I'm sorry, Mitch."
The former Secret Service agent had been poring over building plans and manpower distribution charts to find an escape route for Rapp in case he had to take Taj out himself. The result wasn't much of a surprise. Warch and the Pakistanis had specifically designed their security to be foolproof. If Mari failed, Rapp's best option would be to just stride into the room and put an unsilenced round into the back of Taj's head. The panic would be immediate, and he could use that. With luck, a lot of it, he might be able to disappear into the chaos and make it to the main gate. Mari glanced at a list clipped to the shelf in front of him and froze. When he began moving again, it was to push up his left sleeve.
"This is it," Rapp said quietly.
Warch brought his wrist to his mouth.
"We have a report of a potential threat. Don't make any overt moves, but stay alert."
Warch went for the door to the dining room as Mari casually scratched his arm. It was an admirably practiced motion that brought the poison packet right over the bowl. Even anticipating the move, Rapp was barely able to track what was happening. A moment later, the garnish was in place, and Mari was handing the bowl to a server.
"Ahmed Taj."
The man took it with a curt nod and headed for the dining room. This time Rapp followed, taking up a position along the south wall, where he would be behind Taj. President Tutani was standing next to Sonny Wicca, making a speech about friendship and cooperation. Warch had moved as close as was practical to the Secretary of State, and his eyes were silently taking in the positions of the guests, his men, and Pakistani security. Tutani began acknowledging individual guests as the last of the supos were delivered. Ahmed Taj looked on respectfully, reacting with appropriately enthusiastic nods and smiles as the president outlined his vision for Pakistan. The ISI director was good. Of that there was no question. He exuded the same calm neutrality that Kennedy had mastered, but added to it a vague dullness that she could never pull off. Finally, President Tutani sat down, and after a few cheerful words to Wicca, began eating. Rapp focused on Taj, as the room was filled with the metallic clink of guests picking up their spoons. He had absolutely no idea what to expect. His best guess was that the ISI director would abandon his normal subtlety in favor of something spectacular. He'd picked a public venue full of Americans for a reason. This was about making a statement. It started surprisingly innocuously. Taj coughed, wiping at his mouth and reaching for a glass of water. He brought it to his lips, but wasn't able to swallow, struggling for a moment before spewing it across the table. The man next to him seemed to think that Taj was choking and slapped him on the back. The scene seemed to slow down as Rapp moved a hand toward his weapon. Warch's men were edging in Wicca's direction while one of the ISI men, doubling as a waiter, started toward Taj. All conversations had gone quiet, and everyone's full attention was on the intelligence director. Faces at this point reflected concern but not fear. It was clear that he was breathing, and everyone assumed he'd swallowed something wrong, that he would be fine in a moment. The next time Taj spit something up, it wasn't water. It was blood. He grabbed at his throat and tried to stand, knocking his chair to the floor and then tumbling backward over it. The guards went into motion, drawing their guns and sprinting toward President Tutani and Sonny Wicca. The panic started when Taj vomited a flood of dark fluid, and security began shoving people and furniture out of the way in an effort to evacuate the guests of honor. The attendees were going for whatever exit was closest, some rushing toward the kitchen, others following Tutani and Wicca as they were ushered toward the arch leading to the entry hall. Rapp fought against the momentum of the crowd, forcing his way toward Ahmed Taj. A Pakistani guard reached the stricken man first, aiming his weapon at Rapp when he saw the CIA man closing in. "I'm a medic," Rapp shouted over the chaos around them. Ironically, it was true. He had an advanced EMT certification and was very interested in Taj's condition, though not for the reason most would suspect. The Pakistani lowered his gun and allowed Rapp to roll Taj onto his back. Blood and tissue continued to flow from the ISI director's mouth with each convulsion. But the force was subsiding as his muscles lost their ability to contract. The whites of his eyes had gone red with burst blood vessels, and his gaze wandered blankly until it fell on the American hovering over him. Recognition was immediate, and he suddenly gained the strength to shoot a hand out and grab Rapp's shoulder. "Relax, Director, you're going to be fine," Rapp said, pulling free of the man's grip and pointing to the guard. "If you don't get him to the hospital in the next half hour, there's not going to be any point. Do you understand? There are emergency vehicles out front. Go!" The guard gave him a short nod and began to lift Taj, mistaking the man's thrashing for panic. In fact, he was trying to communicate who Rapp was, but with his throat eaten away, all he could do was gag and struggle uselessly as he was dragged toward the door. Rapp smiled, and the expression made Taj fight even harder. The guard managed to maintain his grip, but it didn't matter. The ISI director would suffocate on his own blood before they made it to the front door. The crowd shifted when the main exit became jammed with people, and Rapp once again found himself being buffeted by the panicked guests. To his right, he spotted a freshman congresswoman who had stumbled and was unable to get back to her feet in the melee. He started toward her and made it to within a couple of yards when someone grabbed him from behind. He spun, prepared to deal with one of the Pakistani guards, but instead found himself face to face with a terrified Carl Ferris.
Where do you think you're going? Get me out of here, you idiot!
Too much booze and the mayhem around them combined to lengthen the time it took Ferris to realize whom he was talking to. When he finally did, Rapp expected him to scurry away. Surprisingly, he did no such thing.
What the hell are you doing here? Now don't answer. Just keep your mouth shut and get me to my limousine.
Clearly, the young congresswoman on her knees didn't concern him. And neither did the fact that he dedicated much of his life to destroying the CIA in general and Rapp in particular. Now that he was in danger, Ferris assumed that Rapp would do whatever was necessary to save him.
Don't just stand there like a...
Ferris was clipped from behind by a woman running in shoes that should have made running impossible. The senator grabbed the front of Rapp's jacket, partially for balance, but also to try to force him toward an exit. They were next to an abandoned table, and Rapp reached for it, retrieving a salad fork and jamming it into Ferris's thigh. The politician let out an ear-splitting scream and collapsed as Rapp went for the congresswoman. He put a hand beneath her arm and pulled her to her feet, supporting her weight as they joined the irresistible current of the fleeing crowd. Epilogue. Outside of Bowling Green, Kentucky, USA. Rapp's opponent was faster than anticipated, and had a gift for using the terrain to his advantage. The sun was out for the first time in a week, filling the air with water vapor rising from the manicured grass. Rows of dew-covered tombstones created a glare that overpowered Rapp's sunglasses and rendered shadows dangerously opaque. He angled left, but then thought better of it and instead slipped into the narrow space between two mausoleums. There was a flicker of movement ahead, and he picked up his pace, staying silent as he broke out into the open again. His target was just ahead, crouched behind a low hedge. Rapp abandoned all stealth and accelerated to a full sprint, coming around the south edge of the bush and grabbing his quarry by the back of the collar. Mike Nash's 4-year-old son squirmed wildly as he was lifted off his feet, but the hand-me-down jacket was too tight for him to slip out of.
"The jig's up, kid."
Chuck had escaped 10 minutes ago, disappearing in a rare moment when both his parents lost focus at the same time.
"I'm bored, Mitch."
"Tough,"
Rapp said, putting him back down.
"Now, march."
Rapp followed, noting that Chuck glanced back every few moments to calculate the odds of another successful escape. To his credit, he recognized that he was beat, and decided to play it cool until another opportunity presented itself. Ahead, the small knot of people surrounding Stan Hurley's coffin came into view. Chuck ran toward his annoyed mother, while Rapp aimed for Irene Kennedy, who was hanging back in a long black coat and a hat that shadowed her face. A man with Stan Hurley's past should have had a much bigger turnout. But the guest list was complicated. Despite his profession, he'd outlived his siblings, and the ex-wives who were still alive wanted nothing to do with him. Two of his 5 children had showed, but the other 3 didn't speak to him. Most of the surviving people he'd worked with over the years were either out of the country or understandably reluctant to publicly acknowledge their relationship. Flowers were everywhere, though, many sent by people who owed Hurley their lives. Scott Coleman and his team were there, as were a scattering of retired CIA operatives. 2 attractive foreign women Rapp didn't recognize were most teary. The odd mix was rounded out by an elderly priest who had served with Hurley in Europe before attending seminary. He was keeping the Bible reading to a minimum, focusing on old war stories instead. While Hurley had been a fundamentally religious man, he'd made it clear that he had no interest in a heaven that would accept him. It was hard for Rapp not to wonder if this was a preview of his own end. 1 week propped up in a freezer before being quietly planted. 1 handful of guests, 1 few mumbled toasts in dives scattered across the globe, and 1 collective sigh of relief from the enemies who had managed to stay 1 step ahead. What would Anna have said? Probably that life and death were about choice, not destiny. That he had the ability to evolve. But into what? There would never be another Anna. And he'd come to believe that was a good thing. She was the love of his life, but that had put him in a terrifying position.
He had worried constantly, not only about her safety, but about what she saw when she looked at him. The coffin began to glide down on its hydraulic lift, just as he came alongside Kennedy.
"I'm going to miss him," she said.
It had been a long and complicated relationship for both of them. She'd known Hurley since she was a child, and in a way he had too. From their early days of trying to beat each other to death, to the man frozen in a chair next to the stakes, it had never been normal. Or boring. "I'm sorry, Irene. It was my op. My failure." The smile that spread across her face was uncharacteristically broad. "He'd have said that it was his op, and you were just tagging along."
"Yeah, I guess he would."
"I was staying in touch with his doctors, Mitch. He wasn't going to last much longer, and the death they described..." Her voice faded for a moment. "I've come to believe that it was better this way." Rapp just nodded. It was a scenario that had scared the hell out of him. Hurley would have never killed himself. Survival was woven into every fiber of his being. And that would have left it to Rapp to slip into the hospital late one night as the shifts were changing. What would it have felt like to press a silencer to Hurley's temple while the old cuss goaded him on? "Are Rickman's files safe?" Rapp asked, as the coffin hit bottom and the funeral started to break up. Chuck was the first to take off, and this time Nash gave chase while the rest of his family dabbed at their eyes with a shared handkerchief. Coleman's people drifted away, leaving only their boss to stare stoically down at the hole. "President Chutani has started an internal investigation. We have a man in his administration who tells us the files were stored on a computer that Ahmed Taj kept in his office safe. Marcus is familiar with the encryption protocol he used and says that it'll take the Pakistanis a minimum of 30 years to crack it. By then, the information will only be interesting to historians." They didn't speak again until they were the only mourners left, watched discreetly from the trees by the men charged with covering Hurley up. "Senator Ferris was trampled during the panic caused by Taj's poisoning," Kennedy said. 6 cracked ribs, a broken wrist, and a puncture wound in his thigh. Last night he was transferred to Bethesda, and he insists that you're responsible, that you stabbed him with a steak knife. Is that true?"
"No."
"You're certain?"
"Positive. It was a fork."
"He told the White House that you tried to kill him."
"I don't try to kill people, Irene. I either do it or I don't."
"That's essentially what I said to President Alexander. And Chutani is extremely grateful for your intervention. According to him, the security footage was somehow corrupted. He also says that he has 2 men who will sign affidavits stating that Ferris was drunk and that you were nowhere near him when he fell."
"Problem solved, then."
"That was pushing the limits, Mitch. Even for you."
"We needed to send a message to that piece of garbage. Consider it sent."
"Fortunately for both of us, President Alexander privately agrees. Having said that, he did mention that if you ever do anything like this again, he's going to personally come to Langley and kick your ass."
Rapp laughed and started toward his car.
"Tell him, any time."
An interview with George Guidel, recorded in the summer of 2015.
Hello, I'm George Guidel. I narrate the Mitch Rapp series by Vince Flynn and now by Kyle Mills. As a narrator, I'm an actor, and narrating books gives me an opportunity to explore a wide range of character, from good people to bad people. Oddly enough, the bad people very often are more colorful, It's a wonderful experience for an actor to stretch himself to various directions, not only vocally, but emotionally, to portray these people that live in an imagined truth in the author's head. And you can look at me as a literary hermit crab. I scuttle along the bottom of the ocean and find myself a home in someone else's imagined truth, and to make that truth come alive for the listener is an absolute pleasure. I do a program around the country called The Art and Artifice of Audiobook Narration, and I speak to people from Maine to Florida, as far west as Missouri, Kansas. They all have listened to a book done by me, which means they've experienced the same event through my eyes, through my gut, through my powers of an interpreter. And that's an amazing feeling. As an audiobook narrator, the listeners are so devoted and so dedicated to listening to stories. It gives me an amazing sense of satisfaction and humility at the same time. They're out there waiting for me to tell them another story because they like the way I tell stories. And that's an absolute pleasure. I love being Mitch Rapp because I'm the farthest thing away from Mitch Rapp you could find. But it's a wonderful feeling to take a voice that a writer has and make it yours. His voice becomes your voice, and that's a nice feeling for a performer. We all need a Superman that is invincible, that is a survivor, pun intended. It's not a question of respecting or liking Mitch Rapp. It's a question of being Mitch Rapp when we see and when we experience him doing what we couldn't possibly do, which is get rid of the evil that exists in the world. He's a marvelous loose cannon in a good sense. I often wonder how he continues to do it, but as long as he's there, I'll be there to help him. I have that Superman costume on when I'm Mitch Rapp, and it's a wonderful feeling because I know I'm invincible. When I come home, I learn that I'm not. I really loved Mitch's mentor and teacher. He's larger than life, and he's a terrific color in the book. It really makes me happy to do him.
Because he has a long voice like that, and he does all kinds of profanity, and he doesn't care about anything.
And it's just fun to do that. Kyle Mills did it perfectly. It's seamless. If no one told me, I would say this is another Vince Flynn book that they found, and I was really impressed with it. We were originally wired to listen to things. There was no book, there was no theater, there was no play, there was just some of us in a cave, and through grunts and through the slow evolution of language, we learned to communicate. This initial genetically wired capability to listen to things still exists, and it is missing for a long time, and that explains the huge phenomenon that audiobooks have become. It's something that every human being needs. You need to be told a story. If you're not listening to a story in a movie, in an audiobook, you're talking to yourself. There has to be some proof of consciousness, and that proof of consciousness is the incoming monologue that we hear either from ourselves or from another source. Here, audiobooks provides the source that is unbeatable. It's with us all the time. There's a group of guys around a pool in Boca Raton in Florida who listens to a book. They stop a chapter, they go into the pool, they come back in the pool, they smoke a cigar, have a drink, and they continue with the book, and they end up reading the book. When I travel around the country, these people are so dedicated, so devoted. There's only one bad part about being an audiobook narrator. I was doing a program with another novelist. This man came up to me at the end of the performance and looked at me and said, "My wife thinks you have the sexiest voice in the audiobook industry." And I said, "Thank you." And he said, "Now that I see you, I'm not worried." Well, just because I'm a little on a senior side doesn't mean anything, but I told him, "Thank you for that. I'm going to use that in every show I do." And that's the joy that you get out of it. People come up to me with so many great stories. So many fans email me all the time saying how much audiobooks have changed their lives. It's given them company. They vicariously experience things they could never experience. Some of the books make you kind of smile. Some of the books scare you, perhaps. Some of the books satisfy the basic human need of being told a story. And that's a fantastic thing. And I'm so humbled and grateful that I can continue to do it. Thank you.
Vince Flynn. The Survivor, a Mitch Rapp novel, was written by Kyle Mills and read by George Goodell. It was recorded by Ethan Donaldson. Editing by Christina Pachano, with post-production by Hudson Sound. The associate producer was Michael Noble. Vince Flynn, The Survivor, a Mitch Rapp novel, was produced and directed by Karen Perlman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Vince Flynn, The Survivor, a Mitch Rapp novel, is available in print from Emily Bessler Books. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Kill Shot and The Last Man, both written by Vince Flynn and read by George Goodell.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.